Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that had a small influence on their work in some strange way. And today, I'm real excited to have actor, writer, director Numa Perrier with me. Hi.
Howdy.
Numa. So, I would love to introduce our listeners to your work and who you are. So, bear with me. This is your life. Born in Haiti and raised in small town USA, mm-hmm. Numa is a Los Angeles-based director, LA, filmmaker and artist. She trained in acting under Milton Katselis, is that correct? Mm-hmm. At Beverly Hills Playhouse and Klimovetskaya.
Yes, very good.
Okay, Polina Klimovetskaya in New York City. Mm-hmm. And she's been an active in the theater for a very long time. Early in her acting career, she landed a recurring role on General Hospital, which was one of my favorites when I was growing
yes.
up. But now you can see her on the Showtime show Smilf. And you can also see her in films including Florida Water, Jericho, and In the Morning. An early creator in the digital space, Numa starred in and was co-creator of the web series The Couple, which landed an HBO deal. She was also co-founder and content director of Black and Sexy TV, an entertainment and lifestyle network focused on young Black progressive audience. She has helmed numerous short films, including Le Petit Mort and Hello Cupid, Farrah. She later started writing a script for her first feature, which would become Jezebel. That project was accepted into the Tribeca Film Institute through her Lens incubation program. Now Jezebel premiered at South by Southwest 2019, so this mm-hmm. year. The film follows 19-year-old Tiffany as she deals with her dying mother and tries to make ends meet when her older phone sex operator sister grooms her to become one of the first Black webcam girls in the 1990s.
Oh, yeah.
there's a lot of stories from the 1990s that are coming out that I think it's just like, oh, wow, it's a re-envisioning of what that decade was like for so many people.
Yeah, exactly. You are not alone.
Yeah. And Jezebel is getting a theatrical release this fall. Jezebel, the story, is actually based on Numa's own relationship with her sister, who also co-produced and financed the film, so it is a family affair. Numa also stars in the film as the older sister alongside Tiffany Tennille playing the younger. So mm-hmm. definitely keep an eye out for that in the fall, and especially New York, LA, but then VOD, you guys can see
right,
it later
exactly,
on, too.
Yeah.
We won't leave you out.
Yes.
So Numa, the film that you chose to talk about today is
Blackula.
Blackula. Can you tell me a little bit about, why it's one of your fave genre films?
I love this film because I'm a big fan of camp. You know, the Met just had their big gala.
Oh, yeah.
Their big ball, and the theme was camp. And I'm a big fan of exaggeration and things being extraordinary, but yet still rooted. It gives you space to deal with the very real issues at the same time. Mm-hmm. In a way that just kind of stretches the mind and that allows humor and that allows sensuality and sexuality and all of those things to come out. And Blackula is a really great example of that. Mm-hmm. And I also really am drawn to taboo subjects. And Blackula definitely is touching on every single taboo that
them.
We are now like having to really create language for, and that we're so focused on unpacking all of these things now that in the early 70s, we were not unpacking things in that way, and certainly didn't have language for a lot of things. But this film went there anyway. And so it's really great to ingest that. It's really great to watch it. It's great visually. It's a good film.
Another thing, again, we were talking about history, but looking back at the 1970s and being like, oh, wow, maybe things were different than what we thought back then, mm-hmm. as portrayed in what this movie is. What is this movie? How did they get this made?
Right.
All of those questions.
Yeah.
And then I think it's also coming back into a lot of people's consciousness now because of the horror noir documentary mm-hmm. On Shudder, and the fact that, you know, you have a reappraisal, obviously, of this film and what it means.
Oh, yeah. I think that they should actually re-release it. I think that would be an incredible experience. I was at the horror noir premiere here in L.A., and William Crane was there talking about the film and some of the challenges he had in making it, and what really excites him about it kind of having this resurgence mm-hmm. right now. So that was pretty neato.
Well, hopefully we can get into some of that. I'm looking forward to some of the insights you may have collected from that talk. For those of you who haven't seen Blackula, today's episode will give you some spoilers, obviously, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Blackula, this is your chance. It's on Shudder right now.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's introduce Blackula with a quick synopsis. Written by Joan Torres and Raymond Koenig and directed by William Crane for release in 1972, Blackula stars William Marshall as Prince Mumawalde, who's coming to Transylvania to convince European statesmen to stop the slave trade. Unfortunately, one of those statesmen is Dracula.
To totally cease the slave trade? I find that unrealistic. Slavery has merit, I believe.
Merit? You find merit in barbarity?
Dracula is pretty happy with his slaves, so as punishment for the prince coming to him, Dracula bites him, seals him in a coffin, and then curses his devoted wife Luva to starve by his side. Flash forward to about a century later, and a gay couple who buys antiques is rummaging through Dracula's castle.
You are obviously not attuned to the antique market.
No. Mm-hmm.
You see where we come from now, honey. The legend of Dracula, I mean, that's the absolute creme de la creme of camp. I mean, we're going to get a fortune for these things.
They ship the coffin to L.A., open it, and become Blackula's first victims. One of the man's friends all come over to see his body. They are Tina, Michelle, and Dr. Gordon Thomas. Blackula sees Tina, who's played by the same actress who played Luva, and he believes it is his bride reincarnated for him.
Because it is.
It is!
Same woman.
It has to be.
Let me try and help you understand.
Is it about your wife?
You are my wife.
That's impossible, Mama Waldy.
And yet you believe it.
Dr. Thomas begins investigating his friend's murder and other murders in the city and becomes suspicious. Meanwhile, Blackula has been stalking Tina. At first, she is frightened, but she gradually begins to find him charming. Dr. Thomas digs up one of Blackula's other victims, who is clearly a vampire, and he drives a stake into the man's heart. Then, Dr. Thomas finds a negative of a photo of Mumawalde with Tina, in which Mumawalde isn't visible.
Wait a minute. There's a big dude with a cape.
Thomas tracks Blackula to his lair. He and the LAPD kill several other vampires. In the fight, one of the officers shoots and kills Tina. Blackula saves her by biting and turning her. Then, another officer thinks he's found Blackula's coffin, so he opens it, and the lieutenant stabs with a stake. Only it was Tina in the coffin. Mumawalde is desperately heartbroken.
My lovely, lovely Tina. What is left for this cursed creature? His only reason for living has been taken away.
He cannot continue with having lost his one true love three times. He walks into the sun and commits suicide.
It's a tragic love story.
It is such a tragic love story.
I also love that it is a beautiful love story. I'm a sucker for that. And in a kind of unexpected way, it is this very sweet story about a man that just carries a flame for this woman forever, through all eternity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
He's charming. He's a handsome man. Mm-hmm. So it's at least that.
That helps.
And I want to talk about, so Blackula was an AIP picture. And for those genre aficionados who are listening, AIP is, you know, they made so many low budget classics. Coffee, The Amityville Horror, The Conqueror Worm, Black Mama, White Mama, Boxcar Bertha, Black Caesar, The Trip, Cry of the Banshees, Bucket of Blood, Squirm, Foxy Brown, The Dunwich Horror, Hell Up in Harlem. Mm. There is so many movies that they made. So, they were kind of a factory. Like, they're trying to churn those things out. And I do have an appreciation sometimes for low budget places that can, you know, experiment and just see what
I do
can
too.
Happen with that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think some of our, you may not realize it at the time, but, you know, yeah, some of our classics, a lot of our classics actually came out of that space. And it was, you know, kind of a nice meeting of commerce versus art for those companies. And the limitations that they presented galvanized some of the art that was going on. So, I have an appreciation for it too. Blackula was definitely. I don't know what the budget was for Blackula.
It doesn't say, but huh. I'm sure William Crane is probably like, I don't know. It's like yeah. nothing, you know.
I wonder.
I'm very impressed with him as a director and what he was able to fight for. And one of the things I wanted to get into was the idea of the African Prince storyline that he was able to inject in this.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's come to talk to European aristocracy and he wants to put an end to European slave trade, which is a point in the story that most people who maybe watched it for a little while, especially white people, they just forgot. They were like, oh, yeah, I thought it was just campy stuff. And then you're like, no, this was a serious thing that kind of started this whole thing. But Manawale was not in the original script. So the whole aspect of him being an African prince was all William Marshall's idea.
Mm.
And William Marshall being Blackula, the actor who portrayed Blackula. So the scene doesn't necessarily fit in the movie in the way that you would expect a normal AIP picture to start. Mm-hmm. That's not how I would see
an AIP
picture.
Yeah, it's kind of like a prologue. Yeah, it's kind of this kind of misshapen prologue, but I think it sets everything off in a great way. So it wasn't an accident, but it kind of feels like a happy accident. Like they improvised a scene and then they're like, actually, we're gonna stick with that. We're gonna go there.
Yeah.
And it's the underbelly of the entire film, so I think they made the right choice.
Marshall said that he would not have acted in the film if they did not acquiesce to him letting this character be an African prince. He was so focused on making sure that this was a character who was seen with the same kind of prestige as any of the white Draculas that had preceded him.
Mm-hmm.
And so apparently it was a caveat that he would not be able to play it unless they made that concession for him. And the character's name originally was supposed to be Amos Brown.
Yeah, so so he got in there and made sure that, you know, his sense of integrity was intact. And I think that's great. And I didn't know that piece of it, that the other name for the character, but I see exactly why he was taken aback by that. He didn't want to push into a stereotype. He didn't want to become iconic for being a trope.
Yeah, because why does the black Dracula have to be any lesser than the white Dracula?
Right.
They all come from some kind of aristocracy, so why wouldn't you have something that was equal to?
Right. It also fits the logic of, and you know, a lot of vampire fans are very, you know, strict about the rules of being a vampire.
Yeah. Are you a general vampire fan? Or
I'm not a connoisseur in a way that, well, I know the rules. You know, for me, I think it's a very flexible thing. Like, it can apply in so many different ways, and it, you know, we can bend and move that idea of vampire around. But there are certain people that are like, no, you only it goes like this, and you know, it's only through biting, and it can't be through, you know. Some people are like, well, vampires can be through scratching and, you know, different things like that. I'm very open to different ways of vampire existing,
It's almost like gender fluidity, but just like vampire fluidity.
It's important, right? I mean, it's, as long as you're getting the blood, you're getting the blood, And, you know, this whole idea of us being eternal beings, but yet physical at the same time can take on so many realms. And so I think that him asking for that was he absolutely should have stuck to that, because there's not just one way, you know, that a vampire can be. And it's certainly not, shouldn't be something that's holding up white supremacy, which I think that, you know, a certain like group of vampire fans, that's the subtext of it.
Yeah.
And that completely gets abolished by Blackula. And I love that the two words just came together so perfectly, you know, Black and Dracula. I'm like, you know, it's brilliant.
It's
so
iconic.
It works. It is.
I'm sure that like the day they thought of it, they were like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. It's very cheeky. But it's also just such a, it's just such a great kind of, you know, middle finger to people that think it can only go one way.
Yeah. So. And, you know, and we'll talk a little bit more about William Marshall and how amazing he is as an actor and how he kind of, you know, carries this whole film and gives it that kind of prestige. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the fight choreography that was going on, some of the low budget restrictions that they have of making Blackula, and generally, you know, some of the issues and topics that this film brought up that were are still relevant today.
Great.
So we'll be right back.
I listen to Reading Glasses because Bria and Mallory have great tips.
My suggestion for book festivals is just go for one day.
I listen for the author interviews.
I was a huge Goosebumps fan.
Oh, yes.
R.L. Stine was totally my jam.
I don't even read. I just like their chemistry together.
Literally, if on the back it said, like, this book made me shit my pants, I'd be like, that's, I'm buying this book.
Yeah.
Like, I think the problem with blurbs a lot of times...
I like that we both want to crap ourselves over books.
I'm Bria Grant.
And I'm Mallory O'Mara.
We're Reading Glasses, and we solve all your bookish problems every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Numa Perrier, and we are talking about Blackula.
Yes.
I love that the idea that AIP was all about don't do retakes. You can do, like, one take, two max.
I love that. That's exactly how I shot Jezebel.
it's a weird thing. And it's one of those things where obviously you can get some bad things from it, but also some interesting things, especially if everyone feels like, oh, I have to nail it in this one time. Like, there's definitely, you know, I was talking about, like, the fight choreography. it's William Marshall who does throw a lot of these punches, and there's definitely times where heads were completely missed, you know, and then they just have to, like, react a second later, like, thrown up. But, like, it's one of those things where I was watching it and the choreography is obviously, like, wrong, but I've seen this movie a lot of times and I didn't totally notice it really until I was watching it with the commentary on, and they were like, oh, he missed his face, and I was like, oh shit, because I just
like, he didn't land anything,
there was nothing. It was just like, that guy just flew for no reason.
Yeah,
but I think that when I have these kind of lower expectations for that kind of realism for something like that it just doesn't really stop me.
Yeah, that's really not what it's about.
It's,
you know,
because
you get it, and it also lends a little towards the campiness of it.
Yeah.
As well, which is, even though, okay, so just because a punch didn't land doesn't mean a punch didn't land.
Yeah.
You know, you're stretching.
That's a good way to say
it. You're stretching your mind.
Yeah.
And you're allowing, and that gives all the space again for the humor to come in, and just for the, just kind of the sheer sense of wonder around that, instead of thinking, that's not right. That it needed to land and the sound needed to hit right then. It's like, no, it's not that type of movie. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe it's not that type of movie because it just couldn't be because of the one take thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also now, okay, we've created a new genre, so get into it.
Mm-hmm. And I love, you know, sometimes there's awkward staging here. Sometimes there's strange deliveries of lines where, like, maybe an actor thought, oh, I'm just going to try it. But that's the one they have to keep, you know?
Yeah.
But that's the kind of thing that makes it strange and iconic. And it also makes it stand out. I'm a big fan of just imperfections. Imperfections and perfect work is, you know, something the way that I would maybe describe a lot of AIP properties.
Yeah, and I think there's a sweet spot for it. I know in Jezebel, we were limited by time and limited by space. And there were a number of scenes where I said to the actors, we're doing this in a one So stay ready. Like, yeah, we're not going to go again. So whatever you need to do, we're doing this once.
Yeah.
And that wasn't every scene, but it was enough scenes. And some of those scenes, one of them in particular, is one of the best scenes in the film. To me, one of the most moving scenes in our film was one that we only did once. And that allows for a freshness that you don't have otherwise.
Yeah. And you prepared your actors. So.
Yeah. Everyone was prepared. Everyone was ready to play. And we just explored in that space and then we had to move on. And with the knowledge that there would be other scenes and other moments where they would get more than one. But filming Jezebel was not, there was not a overabundance of takes on any scene.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely just got in there as prepared as possible and we're very economical about that.
Yeah.
So,
a lot of people think, you know, since it's the digital generation, we're not shooting on film much anymore that like, oh yeah, just shoot whatever. But like, you still don't have time. You still like,
yeah,
there,
you still don't
still
have
limitations.
Time. And I think it's also a little gross to do that. It's wearing on your cast. It's wearing on your crew. It's wearing on your story. It's wearing on the truth of the moment. You got to find the sweet spot. But I'm definitely one that leans towards shooting less and everyone just staying ready, be ready to go.
Mm-hmm. I would love to talk about the interracial gay couple in this movie.
Okay, let's do it.
Let's talk about things that...
intersection.
It's a really interesting thing. I mean, not that AIP doesn't kind of go there in some of their other things, but it just feels like Blackula, it goes so many places.
Yeah, I feel like they threw everything into this film.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to do police brutality. We're going to throw everything that you're uncomfortable with, you're going to be confronted with in this film. That's another reason I love it.
And it's funny, you know, if you look at Ted Harris is the actor who plays Bobby Boyd, and Bobby and Billy are the stereotypically gay men, the couple.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you look into the history of it, those characters were apparently offensive by 1972 terms as well.
Mm-hmm.
But they do exist in this movie, and their being gay isn't the big problem. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that,
right.
It's a strange thing that like that's not the big problem about them in the movie.
Right.
They just exist in this way and they are antique hunters.
Yeah. So there's this kind of dual thing going on where, yes, being gay is not presented as a problem, but yet they are still still in the field of caricature.
Yeah.
So on one hand, it kind of feels like forward motion, but also backwards motion.
Yeah. Which you could say for Blackula too.
Absolutely.
In some ways. Yeah.
I would say that for the whole film.
Yeah.
It's kind of pushing the needle forward and kind of edging us towards something, but at the same time, it's keeping us within the confines of what I guess AIP needed to deliver for their audience, you know, or what, you know, they felt the culture wanted.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily always accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But the more that something is successful, the more that it's deemed as accurate. So I think that you're kind of playing with both of those things at the same time.
And also just the fact that it's an interracial gay couple, like another level of like, okay, like, it's hurting my brain how much there must have been like so much thought that went into.
Yeah, I would love to have or be able to hear any discussions around the script.
Scene. Yeah, like did Crane do colorblind casting? Or I don't understand, you know, like what did he do?
I wouldn't think that.
Right?
I wouldn't think that I think everything in this film is very intentional.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's a moment where it's just, well, we'll just see who the best person is for the job. I think it's like, yes, best person for the job, but also we're going to hit this. We're going to hit that. Like, it's relentless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every single scene, you're having to catch up to something and deal with something. You know, like right when you think, oh, I don't have an issue with this, I don't have an issue with that. Well, next scene, there's something that
maybe I do have
disturbs
an issue with
you.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something that you will find disturbing or that's going to hit your nerve.
I'm curious, when Crane was talking about this, was he talking about kind of the purposefulness of his choices throughout? Is that what made you feel like every bit of it, this was intentional?
No, you know, he didn't really speak a lot. He was on the panel.
Yeah, I was going to say, because it is hard to find interviews with him, so it was hard for me to do research.
He was rather quiet.
Yeah.
He did launch into, you know, the difficulties of getting what he wanted in the film. And I don't know, I'm not sure how to interpret that. I don't know if I should interpret that as he has some regrets as to something. I don't know. I don't want to project that onto it. He just didn't speak a lot about the issues that were raised in the film. Mm-hmm. But it was also a full panel of people. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Well,
I would like to know.
I know.
We should get him in here.
It's tough. It's really tough to find, you know, kind of sizable, full interviews with people from this. Even when William Marshall was doing interviews, he was doing interviews about his plays that he was in. Hmm. And they would just ask him sometimes about Blackula. So you can...
He go into it, or
he would say like little bits and pieces, but he would always return to like and my role in the theater. You know, like
you
this.
Know, maybe you know, it's funny because we could love the film so much, and they may not feel that way about what they did. I don't know.
Yeah,
but it's very possible that we have a different perception of it. Wasn't there a lot of backlash towards all of these films at the time?
Yes, everything.
So, I mean, if you can just imagine being the star of a film.
Like within his own community.
And having, yeah, you know, being Black, being the star of your film, and having really a lot come back at you from us, from us as Black people, you know, having a lot kind of come back at you and not wanting to be defined by that. So I don't know if that's the way the director feels or the stars of the film feel, but no actor wants to only be known for one thing.
Whether or not it's this.
You know, when they have a large body of work. But I would be curious to kind of know more deeply. You've had actors, you know, Viola Davis, you know, speak out later about how she really felt about doing the film, The Help, you know, and...
In your career, have you ever felt like you regretted anything that you did?
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there have been projects that I've been a part of that you always find something to not regret and you just want to focus on that.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes you just wish things could have been better, that you could have been better. There are projects that I've done where I'm like, oh, you know, I just don't feel like I was great in that, you know, and I have to take responsibility for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that every actor has at least one thing like that where they're like, please don't watch that. Please don't, you know. I think as a director, I don't have anything that I regret as a director. As a director, everything's been exactly what I wanted to do, what deeply excited me, what moved me emotionally. As an actor, there's different variables around how something, you know, you're not in the editing room. You're not. It's very different, and you have to lose yourself in a different way. So that vulnerability could go so many different ways. You know, and as a director, I'm vulnerable in a different way. I have to be completely vulnerable and present with my actors on set. But then when it's time to edit, it's a whole other party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have the final say.
I like that you think of post-production as a party, because it's not a party. It is
a party to me. I love editing. Editing is like, I get up in the morning for an edit just as energized as I do, you know, going to set. I love that process.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, maybe we'll continue this conversation we picked up, because we do want to think about, you know, who is the hero of this film? Because there's some disputes about that, and you know, it's an interesting topic. So we'll take one break and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Joe Firestone.
And I'm Manolo Moreno.
And we're the hosts of Dr. Game Show, which is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, regardless of quality or content, with in-studio guests and callers from all over the world.
And you can win a custom magnet. Subscribe now to make sure you get our next episode.
What's an example of a game, Manolo?
Pokemon or medication.
How do you play that?
You have to guess if something's a Pokemon name or medication.
Medication.
First time listener, if you want to listen to episode highlights and also know how to participate, follow Dr. Game Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We'd love to hear
from
you.
It's really fun.
For the whole family, we'll be every other Wednesday starting March 13th, and we're coming to Max Fun!
Snorlax.
Pokemon?
Yes.
Nice.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Numa Perrier, and we're talking about Blackula. Let's get into it. Who's the hero of the film? You said you have ideas.
Tina's a hero.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
The woman's the hero. The object of affection is the hero of the movie.
Tell me more.
Even though, tragically.
Yeah.
The tragic
hero. She dies
hero.
Fucking three times.
Yeah.
In this-
yeah. But I think without her, we don't really have anything to hold on to. She holds the film together because she's the object of desire, you know, like the deepest desire that you want to, mm-hmm. you know, the eternal companion. And so for that, I believe she's our hero.
I mean, I think I can buy that more than maybe some of the other explanations, because the idea is like, is it the doctor or is it actually Blackula? You know, is it Prince Mamawalde or is it the doctor? Because the doctor is hunting him down. And usually in these stories, it would be the hero is the person who kills the vampires. Mm-hmm. And this one, you're definitely kind of rooting for the vampire.
Yeah, I think that it depends on how you center a vampire in general.
Yeah.
Like, is a vampire a villainous creature because they are immortal? Like, why? Because they turn others, because they give eternal life? Why does that make them the villain? I think that there's just, it's a little bit sign of the times that we naturally look to the men in the movie,
mm-hmm.
Because maybe they're speaking more.
Venena McKee doesn't get that many
Yeah, she doesn't
lines.
Have a lot of screen time compared to them. But she's in there, you know. But I think that it's just like adjusting our perception around all the players in the movie,
mm-hmm.
and thinking about, oh, actually, the real focal point is this woman, even though she doesn't have as much of a voice as everyone else.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to
She's a low-key hero.
She is. I wanted to talk about, you know, the bit of low-budgetness in movies where you have to shoot wherever you can.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that is
Love
really
it.
Striking in, mm-hmm. you know, low-budget movies where if you notice it, you're like, wow, really creative. Good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to say that in Blackula, you know, you've got like the morgue, but that doesn't look like a morgue. It's just like an office and someone,
right.
I think it's an office in AIP's office, they said.
I'm sure it is.
And they just put, they just put like a morgue sign on it. And they just had to like move the people out of the office for
gosh.
A little while.
This has been, you know, almost every project that I've worked on, definitely most of the projects that I've created. I'm really impatient and I would rather just move into filming than wait for every circumstance to be so perfect. And I
sure.
see, you know, too many of my peers just not making their stuff because they're like, we have to get this and we have to get that. And it's like, well, eventually you are going to get that. Don't worry, but
mm-hmm.
just make that shit happen, you know? And so I've definitely, you know, filmed in every home that I've ever lived in has been a set. In Jezebel, we... you know,
tax write-off, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It takes courage to do that too, right? That's
yes.
why they call it guerrilla filmmaking.
Yep.
You know, because you're out there like a guerrilla soldier, you know, just surviving and getting the shot. And so in Jezebel, all of our bus scenes, which we shot in Las Vegas, we just got on the bus and shot those scenes.
Mm-hmm.
No permit, no permission, no conversation. We just got our crew together, got on the bus, you paid the bus fare, went to the back of the bus and started shooting, and we got all this amazing footage off of that, you know. And you know, we have
bus fare is not that expensive.
We have a movie, yeah. But trying to, you know, lock down a bus, that's impossible, you know, for a micro budget feature.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's like you're not gonna get it, you know. So we got amazing things that way. And in Blackula, I guess, yeah, that you just make what you have work, and then eventually you'll have more.
Yeah. I always appreciate that, especially in low budget films, you know, whatever people can catch, whatever footage they can catch. It's like Larry Cohen, who just passed away, you know, mm-hmm. he's really famous for catching footage wherever he possibly could.
I love it. I love it so much. And I think that, you know, for Black filmmakers specifically, we should be more okay with that. I feel like more permission is kind of given to filmmakers who are not Black mm-hmm. to do that. You know, it's seen as being artful. It's seen as being creative. It's seen as being brilliant, even. Mm-hmm. And it's seen as low budget when we do it. Mm-hmm. And I really want to dispel that, because we're all just doing the same thing, just getting out there and getting the shot, you know, however we can.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant for all of us when we achieve that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's something that I'll probably continue to do as necessary, which seems to be always. So
yeah, and then you'll get to earn your auteur title.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. It's like, no, it's brilliant. Thanks. That was brilliant.
I'm just gonna let you know that was very brilliant.
Yeah,
what I did
that
there
was brilliant. It's not just what's my dear director's name? Tangerine.
Oh, Sean Baker.
It's not just Sean Baker, you know, that can, like, go out and make an iPhone movie, you know. A Black filmmaker can also do this. It's the same brilliance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to get into a little bit of something that we had already kind of talked about, but that was the fact that this is kind of a chaste film for this time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this does go back to what you were talking about, where this Blackula's confessing his love to this woman and how tender that moment is. And then it's just kind of two people talking and kind of showing love and devotion. And, you know, he's saying essentially, like, I'm not going to force myself upon you.
Well, you must come to me freely with love, or not at all. I will not take you by force.
I'm not going to do anything to you. Like, I have these powers, and I'm, you know, I come to you to just like an open heart, and that's all that it is. Whereas I think a lot of the exploitation films at that time, you know, you have characters who are Black who are always pimps, or the way that they desire women is that they take women, you know, and this kind of caricatured way of what being a Black man was. Mm. And, you know, William Marshall really pushed back against that.
That's what I was going to ask. Is that something, again, that he pushed back against in that scene, I wonder?
Yeah.
I wonder if it was originally another way and got kind of pushed more his way, because it's really quite striking that that character would even have to say that, that a man who loves a woman would have to reveal to her up front that he's not going to hurt her,
mm-hmm.
that he's not going to rape her or kill her or, you know, enact any sort of violence or anything against her will, that would have to be kind of the opening statement
mm-hmm.
to his love poem to her. So that is, it's quite striking. And I'm wondering what the source of that was.
Yeah. I mean, so, and people have talked about this too, where the way that Blackula is torn from his love very much mirrors the way that any kind of African-Americans who had roots back into slavery times, you know, they were constantly torn apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so this feels like, when I watch that scene, and it feels really evocative of that time. Like,
mm-hmm.
you can sense that there's something more serious happening in mm-hmm. that scene than just a vampire who is talking to his, like, rebirthed wife. It feels different.
Yeah, well, I think that when you think about vampires and you think about eternal existence and over many, many lifetimes, of course you're going to encounter the lifetime of slavery.
Yeah.
Because that's right there, and that would have been part of the existence. So that's not something that would not get past a seasoned actor or hopefully, you know, anyone on that set. You know, that's you know, whether you create backstories or not as an actor, that's just something that would reveal itself to you. If you're a vampire, you've been a slave then. And so that should inform at some point one of those scenes, if not your entire performance throughout. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that the actors just knew that's cultural.
I wanted to kind of wrap up our discussion with maybe hitting the topic of the ending, because I feel like we can't get out of here without talking about the fact that the LAPD does kill
Specifically, Los Angeles Police Department.
Yeah, it is,
you know,
very specific.
Not just like any police department, Los Angeles.
Yeah, and you know, some people who don't live in LA or who are not familiar, they think that maybe LAPD was like had problems only around Rodney King.
Right.
But like, it's been systemically one of the more problematic police departments in the nation for a very long time. So this is a topic that had been talked about quite a bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, his love is killed by the LAPD and he commits suicide. And these are two things that are like, what? This is a vampire movie? What the fuck? Because, like, first off, the vampires rarely commit suicide in any of these movies, but he's so torn up by his grief that there's no way to live on, you know?
But don't you think that there's quite a desire or suicidal nature around vampires? I feel that there very well could be, because you're living through so much kind of repeated torment and pain that even though you're eternal, that may not be what you want. And so how do you end being eternal?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that speaks to, you know, human life as well. You know, people who want to end their life, they want to stop some type of cycle that they feel there's no other way out of. And it's really a tragic thing.
It's really moving. So, I mean, like you're saying, it's just like the double-edged sword of eternal life is ideations of death, because it's the one thing you can't have.
Yeah, you can't... you can't talk about vampires and being immortal without talking about the desires around that and the pain around that.
Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, obviously that has more depth than some other vampire properties that
but
exist.
It's always there.
It is always there. And a lot of people have brought up, they've always wondered, you know, is it is this a story of metaphorical slavery, or is it a Dracula film with little depth? And I've heard this in discussions, you know, about what Blackula is, you know, like, is it a vampire film with little depth and we are just trying to add all these things into it, or does it have this very literal metaphorical thing to it?
I think it's pretty literal. I mean, you know, but it could still have a superficial kind of glaze, you know, and that's how you're able to enjoy it and find humor in it and find other feelings around it other than the absolute tragedy that the story is, you know. And so I think that is the balance that AIP is consistently trying to go for. And that in Blackula, they were able to just hit it because... is a vampire. You know, with a vampire, you can just go so far. You can go to so many, you can reach to so many different areas. It was kind of the perfect backdrop for it, which is why I think it actually did so well. Because on one level, you could enjoy the film and kind of privately, if you wanted to, deal with the other issues that came up for you. And it didn't have to be something that was so in your face.
Yeah.
Even though all those things are happening in the movie.
It's more of a subconscious level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that you're leaving us with the idea that, yes, you can talk about important things, but hey, how about just a little bit of fun in the movies too?
Yeah, some levity, please, always. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming to talk with me today, Numa.
Thank you.
And your movie Jezebel will be in theaters later in the fall. So, again, please keep an eye out if you're in Los Angeles or New York, and then an eye out for the VOD release as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple. Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. Here's one from IRL Morg. They say, my new favorite podcast. I had a difficult time finding an in-depth podcast on film of modern and retro favorites that didn't lose my attention, but I have finally found the one. April Wolf is an engaging, informative host who does an excellent job of asking the perfect questions to the guests and educating me along the way. I love every minute of it and hope it gets the recognition it deserves. My personal favorite episode was Raw with Barbara Crampton. Excited for more to come. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And check out our Facebook group too. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Where's that big dude with the cape?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.